Over in North Carolina, we've got a tradition. So let's pray the serenity prayer, y'all. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
I'm an alcoholic. My name's Mike Burns.
Mike.
I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me, and Mike's just been awesome. He picked me up at the airport. He's been taking good care of me, and it's just been an incredible weekend for me. And I go to a men's retreat up in Western North Carolina in the mountains, and it just feels like home being at places like this, you know. And we can max out at 280, so it's about the same, you know, amount of people. And we do things a little bit different. We got about 150 of them at tent camp, and it's a little bit different format, but it's all the same, you know. And this guy, he's been fun to be around, and it's just been incredible, the hospitality, and I really appreciate it. It's been awesome. There's some guys in this room that are my heroes, and there's a few of them that's been down around my area and sharing their stories with us, and it's always good to see those guys still, you know, and especially to come somewhere like this where they're not, you know, they're not telling their stories and they're involved with the fellowship and sitting around and sharing their experience, you know, because we need those old guys or those young guys with long time to, ain't that right? There you go. He does like this all the time. And there's a new one I met right there. And we need those guys, you know, to hear the stories so we can carry this stuff on, you know. I come from a group, it's called the Big Town Group, and we meet in a small town of Etowah, North Carolina. If you don't know where that's at, that's in between Horseshoe and Pisgah Forest. And you know where that's at? Beautiful place. And to even a bigger picture, if you've ever seen The Last of the Mohicans, all the waterfalls, we're in the land of waterfalls up there in the mountains. It's absolutely beautiful. And we have three meetings a week at that Big Town Group. We have a closed big book study. And my wife and I and this one other guy from Richmond, Virginia that moved down started that group. And, you know, most of the meetings around that area was problem of the day meetings. And you never knew what you were going to get. The first closed AA meeting we went to, it was in another town right close by. It was a closed AA meeting, and a woman slipped on Little Debbie snack cakes, and all the drunks told her how not to slip on Little Debbie snack cakes. And I swear I hope they wasn't no brand newcomers in that meeting that night. But, you know, we were there for a year, and we tried to get in some of these groups and share our experience and all, and the Big Town Group was born, a resentment in the coffee pot. And we started that, and it's absolutely amazing. The format we came up with was all three of our first home groups, and we put together some guidelines, and, you know, it's a closed big book study, and we're getting ready to celebrate 4 years, and it took us 3.5 years to get through those first 164 pages, and it's the chairman's responsibility to look up the history behind what he reads and bring that to the meeting. You know, and when he's doing that, he's talking about traditions, more or less, you know. And it's been absolutely incredible. And that's been an attraction to a lot of people coming in. And, you know, today at almost 4 years old, we've got over 45 home groups in this small little mountain town, 45 home group members. And, you know, Friday night we started another meeting, a Friday night open speaker meeting. And we bring speakers in, and, you know, we get 60, 70, 80 people at that Friday night speaker meeting in that little town. You know, and so we were doing so good, we started a closed step literature study. And the chairman can choose which conference-approved literature he wants to, you know, work that step out of that night. And we also do a tradition the last Tuesday, and we also study the book Comes of Age on the last Sunday of the month. And it's been absolutely amazing. We've drawn these old hillbillies out of them mountains that just kind of quit going to AA meetings because they couldn't stand what was going on. I don't know if they let it get that way down there or if them guys just started coming in there and taking over. I don't know, but these old guys, they hear about Big Town, and they come down there, and they join the group. And we've got a huge variety of all walk of life, a lot of newcomers. We got treatment facilities coming over. We've got old timers in the group, you know, and we need those guys. And it's just absolutely amazing. It just lit a whole new fire under me and my wife, you know. We've both been in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous since we got here, and it's just lit a whole new fire up under us, you know. And it's not Mike and Kathy's group. It's the big town group, and there's a group conscious there, and you know, it's just absolutely amazing. You know, we believe in that fifth tradition to carry the message to the alcoholics instead of sitting there waiting on them. We take meetings into the jails. We take meetings into the detox. We take panels into treatment facilities. We sent big books, grapevines, and CDs to two different groups in Iraq for a year and a half. You know, and the Bullets and Bottles group in Mosul, Iraq. You know, and they sent us a certificate of appreciation to the big town group on a map of Iraq, you know, and we're proud of that. We put it up on our table, you know, and it's just a strong group of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I've been involved with a lot of strong groups in AA over the years, and I'm just so grateful. I came into AA in Charlotte, North Carolina, where there's really strong AA in Charlotte, and I got in with these old guys that they didn't take no junk, man. They said, you know, you ain't got no experience. Shut up, you know. And they weren't afraid to hurt people's feelings, you know. And it just seems to me like just getting really touchy-feely kind of stuff going on these days. And I love these guys, man. I love them. And enough of that. I'm supposed to share in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And I was born in Charlotte back in 1963. I was born into a good family. A good Christian family. My mom, dad left my mama when she was pregnant with me. I had two sisters, a brother waiting on me, you know. My mom couldn't work because she had three small kids, went on the way. So my grandparents took us in their home. And these grandparents adopted my mama when she was 2 years old. And it was just a good home to grow up in. You know, and anything outside of that home as a kid growing up, I was scared to death. As a kid, I don't know why, I was afraid of people. If they weren't in my immediate family, I was afraid of them. And they made sure we all went to church, you know, and I grew up in a Lutheran church and didn't get what they were trying to give me in that church, you know. I've always believed in God because, you know, I was raised up in that atmosphere. My grandparents were awesome people. Never heard them raise their voice, you know, always helping people. And they taught us everything they were supposed to teach us growing up as kids, you know. But I didn't feel comfortable, and I didn't have any self-esteem. Growing up with them guys I grew up with, you know, they were always better than me, I thought. Well, I took my first drink at 11 years old. I don't remember taking it, but a friend of mine told me about it later on in sobriety. But I remember at 12 years old camping out in the backyard with some friends, and these older guys were having a keg party in the house. They couldn't drink liquor. They weren't old enough to drink liquor in the house, so they'd bring it out where we were. I guess they thought it'd be funny to see little brother and friends get drunk, so we're out there drinking whiskey, chasing it with draft beer, throwing it up and drinking some more, and a couple of them got it down. I said, man, I've got to get it down. You know, I knew I had to be like them, and I got enough down. And I'll tell you, man, like the book talks about, we drink essentially for the effect. Man, it took that fear away from me, man. I'm going to tell you, it became my instant power. You know, I could go places I normally couldn't go. I could do things I normally couldn't do. Talk to people I normally couldn't talk to. And I knew right then I was going to drink every chance I got. And I did. And by the time I was 15, I drank every day. I was a blackout drinker from the start, you know. 12, 13 years old, we'd walk the railroad tracks to school. The only thing I knew about alcohol was the winos up under the bridge, you know. And we'd pitch our lunch money in, 12, 13 years old, get those winos to get us something to drink on the way to school, you know. So morning drink just came natural. You know, we was drinking Wild Irish Rose and that. You ever had any of that Orange Jubilee? Well, that stuff, good stuff, you know. And we'd kill out a couple pints of that Orange Jubilee, and we'd go on down to the schoolhouse. And I hated going to school from the first grade. And a lot of times we'd overshoot the mark, and we just wouldn't go to school. So I started skipping school on a regular basis in the sixth grade. You know, I'd rather be out there drinking with them guys. And we did, you know. By the time I was 15, I was drinking every day. I was blacking out all the time. I went to a New Year's Eve party two blocks from my house. Came to a Daytona Beach, Florida. Don't know how I got there. You know, and you know, well, I'm there now. What do? I found homeless guys because I'm homeless, you know. And they taught me how to do some stuff out on the streets and make a little bit. 3 weeks later, I was down in Lakeland, Florida, got locked up my first time when I was 15. And they put me in a little juvenile prison for about 3 days, and they sent me back to Charlotte, North Carolina on probation. Got back, my mama told me I needed to turn myself in. I said, for what? Me and a buddy of mine robbed some little old lady in the neighborhood park in a blackout, don't remember doing it. You know, and so things were really happening to me, some serious stuff, early in sobriety, early in drinking. And I didn't see it as alcohol being the problem. If I wasn't with that boy in that park, we wouldn't have robbed some little old lady. It was my attitude, you know. And so from then until I got AA, I was just in and out of jails. And like I said, I hated going to school. Junior high school, I made D's and F's, and they passed me every year. They sent me to the 10th grade. The only thing I remember about the 10th grade is it was the funnest 3 years of my life, you know. And I just we'd go in the front door and head out the back. Go out in the woods and drink. And, you know, and that was just, we were just wide open. All the guys I grew up with was just like that, you know. And ended up, my mom told me if I wasn't going to school, I was going to have to go to work. So I quit school, went to work doing carpenter work, found out them guys drank on the job. I believe I made a brilliant decision, you know. Every job I ever have, I'm going to find one I can drink on. And I worked with these guys from North Wilkesboro, and they drank corn liquor and smoked homegrown. I didn't like the homegrown, but I drank the liquor with them. And they started drinking at 10 o'clock in the morning, you know, and they did prefab apartment buildings, you know, and I could get the courage up when I had a few drinks in me to top plate them third-story buildings, you know. And I remember we was up on the second floor one day. We was all standing around, and Harley was the boss man. Five of his sons worked there, me and one of my other buddies. And I remember we was all up there waiting on the forklift driver to bring some walls up there to us, and the superintendent over the job came up the ladder and said, where's Harley at? And we looked around. Well, he was just here. A couple minutes later, Harley came up the ladder, you know, and we didn't know it until on the way home. Harley turned around and stepped off the second floor of that building. And, you know, it didn't faze him. He just come right back up the ladder, you know. So when you work with people like that, you can't get fired, you know. But old Harley died, and then all five sons become the boss, and you know how that worked, and, you know, it just, and I moved on. But, you know, it was, when I was 21 years old, I finally got my driver's license for the first time. I wanted to find a job where I can drive one of their vehicles, you know, because all my money went on drinking. And whenever I didn't feel comfortable staying somewhere, I'd just move on. If it meant staying on the streets, I'd stay on the streets. And I slept on a lot of couches. And I remember I got my license, and I found a job installing cable TV for a contracting company in Charlotte. And for a week, this guy trained me how to install cable TV in these houses, you know. And they cut me loose, and they gave me a big, long van to work out of. Well, I felt pretty comfortable in that van, so I packed my clothes up and moved in that van. You know, and I'd camp out on dead-end roads or pull down on this creek bank we used to drink on, you know. I was down on this creek bank one night. We was down there drinking liquor, and I remember this girl came up, and it was a girl I knew from church when I was a little kid. And I hadn't seen her in years, and she didn't like where she was living, so I let her move in with me, you know. We drank all the time, and I always come to at daybreak and make it to work, you know. Well, my best friend was 23 years old, and his daddy wouldn't let him in the house, but he let him sleep out in his backyard in a 56 Chevrolet station wagon. He had a tarp over it where you couldn't see in or out of it, you know. And it was sitting on blocks. It didn't have a motor in it. His daddy let him have a drop cord to hook the power up out there. And bought him one of them strip plugs where you can hook six different appliances up to it. And had a little heater for the winter, a fan for the summer, a little color TV, stereo. And his girlfriend lived with him out there in that car for 3 years. Doing the work I did, I hooked their HBO and Cinemax up out there for them. Me and my girl was riding around drinking. If a good movie comes on or a good fight on HBO, we'd go to their house, you know. I don't know about y'all, but, you know, you get a half gallon or a fifth of liquor in a small place like that with another couple, you know, a fight's going to break out. And we'd roll out the back door fighting. Finally, his daddy got tired of it and run us all off, you know. And, Being the good friend I was, I let them move in with us. So we got two couples living in the Cablevision van. I don't know about y'all, you know, roommates are hard, right? And especially in a small place like that, you know, it's things started going downhill not long after they moved in. And I remember we was out, you know, there's a place called Hubie's Bubble Up. It's out on the river. It's an old biker bar down there on the river. And there was an old trailer park down there. And some of them guys I worked with lived down there, you know, and it was right outside of Charlotte. And we were down there drinking one night, and this guy said, "Mike, why don't you take my boy down to some of them bars in Charlotte?" They weren't nothing but beer joints down there. And this guy's never been in a bar, and he was 15 years old. I was in my early 20s, and he was a big old boy. He could drink a lot of beer. I said, "All right, I'll take him," you know. And I took him to Charlotte, and I bought me a fifth of George Dickel White Label. Well, that's some good stuff, ain't it? Bought me a fifth. I bought him a 12-pack of Budweiser, and I was chasing my liquor with his beer, and we're just hitting all these bars. And I remember we was riding down this road. I told that boy to grab the steering wheel so I could take a drink, and he did, and I took a drink of liquor and chased it, and blue lights came on. And I pulled over, and that cop come up to my window, and I looked at him, and I said, "Was I speeding?" And he said, "No, you crossed that center line back there." Well, I just leaned back and said, "Well, you don't talk to this boy over here. He was steering." You know, and, and I still say they got the wrong guy, but they drug me out and locked me up. They didn't give me no roadside test. They impounded our home, you know, and by this time, I've been to jail so much in Charlotte, I had a bondsman named Blue that would come get me out on credit, meet me at the bank on Fridays. You know, and I found out how that worked real quick. I called my mama one of the first times I got locked up, and don't do that. And I found out about bondsman, and I got this guy, and, you know, and I found out, you know, I went in there so frequently that he would get me out on credit, meet me at the bank on Friday. Well, he wouldn't come down there at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning on a little misdemeanor drunk charge for a $100 bond, you know, so I found out if you cuss the magistrate out, they'll jack your bond up, and then Blue would come there and get me, you know. And so I was working all this stuff out as I go. And so, but old Blue, he came there and got me that night, and I got out, and I walked the streets of Charlotte, and I knew where that truck was, and went over to this place called Davidson Record Company in a rough neighborhood, waited for them to open up, and I remember I begged and pleaded to get that van out. It wasn't mine. I need to go to work, you know. And they finally gave it to me, and I went to work that day. And very next weekend, I got another DWI. And it just kept getting worse and worse, man. We got a larceny charge in that van one night, stealing some beer out of a convenience store. You can't get away from the law at 2 o'clock in the morning in a Cablevision van with ladders on top. You can't do it. And so I ended up, I quit that job. I went there and threw my keys down. They said, "Why are you quitting?" I said, "Man, it cost me too much money to work for you people." You know? I quit. Find out when you don't have a car or job, your girlfriend will leave you, and she left. And I just went to the streets, you know, and I stayed wherever I could. You know, I'd go to these bars. I always had a job. I had money in my pocket. And I'd go to these bars, you know, and I'd set up somebody with a few beers, you know, and I'd say, "Man, let's get a fifth of liquor and go to your house." And then I'd get in there. And I'd stay as long as I could stay, you know, and I did that all the time. And I was in a bar one night, and this girl came in, and she said, "Aren't you Bobby's brother?" And I said, "Yeah." I hadn't seen my brother in about 5 years. So her and this other guy took me over into North Charlotte, which is a pretty rough area. And we pulled in this driveway, and there was 30 Harley-Davidson motorcycles in that yard. Went in this house, bikers in there drinking liquor and having a good time, you know, and I felt comfortable right there, so I just stayed there. Come to find out my brother was the president of a club there in Charlotte, and that was their clubhouse, and I moved in with them. Went to work with some of them guys with brick masons. I went to work with them mixing mortar and hauling brick, and they drank around the clock, you know. And we was in there one night, and I think it was me and Toad and Snake was sitting there drinking a half gallon of Jim Beam, and I remember the bathroom door down the hall opened up, and out stepped this beautiful Mi'kmaq Indian. She had hair down to her belt. I had hair down to my belt. She had more tattoos than I got, and that impressed me. And we drank that liquor. I blacked out. I don't know what happened. A month later, I was in a bar, and that Indian come in the door. She had this young guy with her. She comes straight over there to me. She said, Mike, I'm taking you home with me tonight. I said, okay. You know, I'm pretty easy when I'm drunk, y'all. And she told me, you are too, ain't you? She took me home with her. You know, she lived in a, I don't know if y'all got drunk trailer parks out here in Texas. The whole trailer park is drunk. And she took me to this place, you know, and they should have condemned the place 30, 40 years ago. But we went in there and started drinking a fifth of Jim Beam. We walked in the trailer, the first thing, it was sitting like this. So when you walked in, you just went downhill, you know. And but we got in there drinking, you know, and the wind started blowing so hard, I thought it was going to blow the trailer over, you know. And we drank that fifth and passed out. Well, when we came to, we went outside that trailer, and there was pine trees laying through trailers. And we didn't know what in the world happened. Went over and knocked on the neighbor's door and asked him what happened. And Hurricane Hugo hit that night. And, you know, it came in Charleston down there in South Carolina, but it came 200 miles in, and it tore Charlotte, North Carolina up. You know, so we couldn't even drive out of the trailer park, so I was with the woman of my dreams, so I just never left, you know. We became good, you know, best drinking buddies, and we drank all the time. Both of us in and out of jails, both of us, you know, always looking for jobs and slipping out when the rent's due, and, you know, we were just wide open, and, me and that woman, we ended up getting married in a beer joint down in Charleston, South Carolina. Her sister married us. That's a redneck wedding, y'all. And, a lot of people used to say, y'all ain't really married. I knew we were because I had to pay for the divorce. But, but we drank around the clock, you know. And I remember we was in a bar one night drinking, and I remember a fight broke out, and there was 20, 30 people in there swinging, and I just, that's my kind of atmosphere. I jumped right in the middle of it, and the next thing I know, I came to in a jail, didn't know why I was in there, and that's happened a pretty good many mornings, you know, and it wasn't no big deal at the time. And I remember I reached in my pockets, and I pulled some papers out, and the paper said I assaulted a female in a bar, and I don't remember hitting no woman in there. But I remember I called Blue, and he came and got me out on credit that day. I went home, and we lived in a little efficiency apartment. And when I walked in that door, all her stuff was gone. There was two boxes sitting by the front door. And I opened up the fridge, and there was a couple beers in there, and I drank those. And not long after that, the front door opened up, and in stepped that Indian with one of her friends, and I saw who I hit in that ballroom. I put 15 stitches across her head right here, and that tore me up, you know. And I remember she got her stuff and left, and I got evicted out of this place and went back to the streets of Charlotte. I walked streets, you know, and I couldn't get that off my mind, what I did to her, you know. I found these old guys I grew up with that was, they conned some people out of a house. They let me sleep on their couch for 50 bucks a week. And I remember there was 20 or 30 drunks in there at all times, drinking, partying. Law was always over there. And I remember I was walking the streets of Charlotte, you know, and I found her over in North Charlotte. I begged and pleaded that woman to get back together. And she said, Mike, if you move back to your mama's house and quit drinking, we might get back together. You know, that's the last place on earth I want to go at 28 years old. You know, but at this time in my life, I was tired of the way I was living life. I was on the streets. I didn't know where my next meal was coming from. I didn't know, you know, I couldn't work. And I was just sick, man. I was tired of living that way. And I didn't know any other way to live. I didn't have a clue how to live life without drinking. And so I went back up to my mom's, and my mom always told me, if you ever need to come home, come home. You know, I used to say I wouldn't go home because I was too proud or whatever. And I realized today I didn't want to go back home because I didn't want her to see me in the condition I got myself into. You know, any of my family. I just shut my family off for 20 years. I didn't want them to see me like I was, you know. And I went home, and it wasn't long after that, you know, we had to go to court, and she got there before I did, and she tried to drop the charges. They wouldn't do it because it was the state against me. And I remember judge came in, and the DA read the charge to the judge, told the judge what happened. And the judge looked at my wife and said, what do you want to do with them? You know, and I had my toothbrush in my back pocket because I figured I was going to be staying for a while. And I remember my wife stood up, and she told that judge, she said, Mike's a good man when he don't drink. Said he works hard, he helps his mom when she needs help, but he's crazy when he drinks. And she sat down. And I guess that judge was looking at my record, and I've seen it since then. And he told me to stand up, and I stood up, and he said, "Mr. Burns, I'm going to send you to a place called Alcoholics Anonymous. Those people can help you." And I was 28 years old, and that was the first time I ever heard of AA. He gave me a 2-year sentence suspended with 2-year supervised probation. He sent me to another program called NOVA for 6 months for men who assault their women. And he sent me to a treatment center to take an assessment. I didn't know what that was. Well, I went down the hall, I met the probation officer, I met the meanest woman I ever met in my life. And she said, "Mike, when you have an appointment to see me, if you're late, I'm going to have you locked up." I'd go early, and she'd cuss me out for coming too early. And, you know, I did everything that woman told me to do. I knew that if I did whatever she told me to do, it would be a better deal than going and doing 2 years in prison. I knew it, you know. You ain't got to be the head cashier at Walmart to figure that out, right? One of these days, the head cashier is going to come up to me and give me some. So I did everything they told me to do, you know, and I went over to this treatment center, didn't know what it was. I went in there and they asked me 150 questions, and I got one wrong. They told me I was an alcoholic. And, exactly. So I went back and told her, and she said, "If you don't do everything they tell you to do, I'm going to have you locked up." So I was a perfect student in them classes, you know. I'd show up and I'd do what I was supposed to do, and I hated every minute of it. I hung out with a group of guys who didn't want to be there, who didn't plan on staying sober, you know. And I didn't want to drink anymore, but I didn't want to do what them people had us, you know, doing in that place. And they took us. Thank God it was a place that took us to AA, you know. It was one of those treatment centers that took us to our first AA meeting. I remember walking in this meeting with about 75, 80 people in there, and the first two people I see is my junior high school principal sitting beside my Sunday school teacher, you know. And that Sunday school teacher's daughter is the one who lived in that van with me, and I was kind of worried about that. You know? But I looked around that room, and I judged everybody in there. I'd wear them cut-off Harley shirts, you know, and I had hair down to my belt, and I had my teeth kicked out in the streets fighting. You know, and nobody in that room looked like me, and I didn't think I was like these people, you know. I didn't feel like I belonged there, but I had to go. I had to prove I was going. And y'all know what that is. I had to prove I was going for 2 years. I had to show them a piece of paper saying I went to these meetings. And I hated it. I hated going to AA meetings. And I remember me and my wife got back together, and she was still drinking. And we'd go, you know, she'd take me to treatment, and I'd go in there, and she'd pick me up, and we'd go to bars. And she'd drink Jim Beam, and I'd drink Sprite. Not a good place to be. And I did that for about a month, and I remember I told her I can't do it no more. And she'd come into AA, and we went to some meetings together. And she found out she didn't like it either. And we didn't drink. And what we found out is when we don't drink, we don't like each other. Matter of fact, we can't stand each other, you know. We both got new jobs. I was working in the daytime. She was working at night. And I'd get home from work, and we'd just argue the whole time. And she'd leave, and I'd be cleaned up, and I'd sit there by myself. And I'd think, what do you do when you don't drink? I didn't know what to do. So I'd go to AA meetings, and I hated going to AA, but that's where I'd go. She'd call in between 8 and 9 o'clock at night, and I wouldn't be there, so she started accusing me of all this stuff. I said, "Look, when I get out of treatment, I won't have to prove I'm going. I'll just quit." She said, "Okay." So I remember 18 and a half weeks, I graduated from treatment. I went home, and next day I went over to my probation officer, threw my paper on the table, said, "I graduated AA. There's my paper." She said, "I'm going to tell you something, Mike. You can get that thing signed for 2 years, show it to me once a month, or I'm going to have you locked up." So I tucked my tail and come on back to AA, you know. And I hated it. But I'll tell you, I came to these meetings, and I sat in the back of the room, and I judged everybody in that room. I hated going to AA. And they'd ask me to read something. I told them I can't read. Leave me alone. You know. And I remember after 8 months of not drinking, things did get better. I could wake up on time. I could make it to work. I worked hard for these people. Me and my wife got back together. I got my driver's license back after 6 years. I bought me an old Ford van to drive to meetings and to work. And Me and my wife, we started buying furniture out of stores instead of getting off the side of the road somewhere, you know. It was looking pretty good. After 8 months, you know, you can find some nice stuff on the side of the road, y'all. But I remember after 8 months, you know, I was at work one day, and I thought, you ain't had a drink in 8 months. Surely you can drink a few beers. I've never thought I could drink a few beers. I went home, started an argument, packed my clothes up, went and got a hotel room and a 12-pack of beer, and I drank 3 or 4 of them beers. I don't know about you, but when I get a buzz, there's always something better happening across town. And I left, went over there, walked in this bar. The bartender was pouring a double shot of tequila. When I got up to him, he was putting Tabasco sauce in there, and I knew that was my drink. He said, "Mike, where you been?" I said, "Man, I've been sober in AA for 8 months." He said, "Boy, you need this." Turned that double shot up and told him to give me another one, and I don't remember leaving that ballroom. I came to the next day at 11 o'clock on the bathroom floor in that hotel room, sick as I ever been. I climbed up on the sink, and I looked in the mirror, and I hated everything I seen in that mirror. I looked like a wild animal. I used to say, I don't know why I came back to AA that night. My old sponsor told me, he said, "You went to AA meetings for 8 months. AA put a booger on you." If you're here today, and if you're planning on going back out there and trying some drinking out there, you've been boogered up. It ain't no fun no more. Right? And I remember, I came back that night. That was September the 17th of 1992. And by God's grace and you people helping me, I hadn't had to take a drink since then. Came back, my wife got drunk, stayed drunk for a couple weeks, and I lived in my van. And I was going to meetings every night and going to work every day. She called me at work one day and wanted me to come back home, and I went back one more time. For the next 11 months, I came here just to prove I was coming here. I didn't do nothing. After 11 months, I came into a meeting, sitting there with 75, 80 people in that room, and I felt like I was all by myself. I couldn't imagine living the rest of my life not drinking. You know, and how it works, it talks about we stood at the turning point. I knew right then I was going to have to make a decision. You know, either I can go back out there and live that rough life out there on the streets drinking and dying alcoholic death, or I can ask some man in here to help me. You know, and I was desperate enough to ask some man to help me, and that was a hard thing to do. It was hard. I seen this guy from New York that ended up in Charlotte. The first guy he met on the streets of Charlotte was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Took him in his home, became his sponsor. This guy helped me, you know. I've had 3 sponsors since I've been sober. And every one of these sponsors, man, they never said, "You better do this, you better do that." You said, "You come go with me and do what I do, and you'll get sober and stay sober." And they've been examples in my life. That guy was an example. And, you know, sometimes people are putting our lives that we need, putting our lives at that time, and he was one of them. You know, this guy was wide open. This dude was going to jail in sobriety. He was 3 years sober. I thought, man, if that dude can stay sober, surely he can help me. And that guy started taking me through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and started sharing his experience, you know, with them 12 steps. And I remember that guy told me, he said, "Mike, you don't have to understand anything we're doing. When we go through this book, if you take the actions, you'll stay sober. I promise you." And I didn't understand everything we was doing, but I just did what that man told me to do, what he suggested, and, you know, and it worked. It worked. And this guy, he'd get in fights in AA, man, and, you know, he was wide open. And I remember I was a year and a half sober, and I started running around with this old-timer, and some of y'all know Buck, down there in Charlotte. And he audio-recorded conventions, you know, and I started going everywhere that man went. And I realized this old man, you know, he's pretty peaceful, you know. He ain't going to jail, you know. And, you know, I kind of, it was more attractive than this guy over here going to jail, so. I asked Buck to be my sponsor. But before that, you know, when I asked this guy to be my sponsor, he said, "Mike, are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober?" I didn't know what he was talking about, but I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Will you freely give away what was freely given to you?" I didn't have a clue what he was talking about, but I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Where do you live at?" And I told him, "In that van," because at 11 months sober, my wife drank again, and I left. And I lived in my van. And I was going to meetings every night. And this guy, he said, "Well, you can stay with me." 2.5 weeks later, I moved in next door to this guy. And we went to meetings every night. This guy started reading the big book to me. And thank God for sponsors who read to you, because I couldn't read that good when I got here. And he started reading to me, and he started sharing his life with me. You know, he started talking about the powerlessness, you know. And I remember, you know, we talked a lot about selfishness and self-centeredness, you know. And I remember he read this paragraph to me in that book, man, and it says, you know, if we're just willing to believe in this power and take a certain attitude toward it and do a few simple things, man, we'll have a revolutionary change in the way we live and think. You know, and I was willing to believe, you know, that this power would work for me, you know, because I believed in God, but I never had faith in it. Never. I never felt like God did anything for me. I never seen him or heard him in anybody. You know, and I can remember when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, the only faith I had, I'd come to down on these creek banks, you know, or come out of these boarding houses, stabbed, cut up, and, you know, and just sick, you know. And I remember the closer I got to that liquor store, the better I felt, because I knew that liquor was going to help me. You know, that's the only faith I had when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and so you take that away, man, I ain't got nothing. You know, and he said, you know, the main object of this book is to enable us to tap into some kind of power that's going to solve your problem. Doesn't say all your problems. It says problem. You know, it's going to take that desire and thoughts away, that, you know, that you're going to have. And, you know, he explained this stuff to me, you know. And I remember we got on our knees and did that third step prayer, you know, and, you know, I didn't know what he was doing. I felt kind of stupid getting down on my knees with another man doing that, you know. I didn't feel no great thing over it or anything. Matter of fact, none of the steps I really felt any big impact on it. I just took the actions and I stayed sober. You know, now that I look back on it, I can see what happened to me when I was doing that stuff. You know, and I remember he said, do you have a home group? I said, no. He said, well, mine's called Late Night Eastside. And it was a group of guys and girls in there, anywhere from 20 to 30 years old. There's about 60 or 70 of them. And these guys, man, they were wide open in Alcoholics Anonymous, man. They took packs of people all over Charlotte, you know, into the prisons, into the jails, into the detoxes, mental health, treatment facilities. You know, they're always doing something. And it was always, you know, men and women going. You know, and one of the greatest things that group taught me is you leave them women alone. Men stick with the men, women stick with the women. You know, and one of the things that they did was, is they went in groups to do this service work, you know, and that's how I became able to have relationships with women, you know, without thinking about using them. You know, that's how I started learning how to become a friend to a woman instead of just an object that I, you know. And so, you know, they taught me a lot of things in that group. I remember I'd stand out there, you know, and they'd say, Mike, if you go where we go and do what we do, you don't ever have to drink again. And they'd say, even better than that, you don't ever have to be alone again. You know, and they hooked me and they reeled me right in that group, you know. I got in that group. They didn't ask me if I wanted to do nothing. They said, you're going to chair the meeting on Friday and make coffee on Saturday. Show me how, you know. And man, I'd make coffee for a 10 o'clock meeting. I'd get there at 8 and put it on, and five or six guys would come over there, and they'd sit and they'd share their experience with me, you know. And sometimes after that 10 o'clock meeting, you know, at night, we'd be out in that parking lot at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. Cops would come through there and tell us to keep it down out there, you know. You know, and these guys, they got together. They went hiking in the mountains. They went rock climbing. They canoed, just all kind of stuff. And they took me in, and they showed me how to have a good time in sobriety. Because when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, man, I thought, this is, you know, how are we going to have fun not drinking, you know? And they showed me how. You know, thank God for those guys. I remember my sponsor was in that group. And his sponsor was in that group. He lives out in Boulder now. But I remember this guy, my grand sponsor, he said, Mike, meet me over here at 2 o'clock. I said, all right. I come over to this meeting at 2 o'clock. He said it was some kind of district meeting. I didn't know what it was. Went in there, and they said, we need a district grapevine rep. And my sponsor, he said, I nominate Mike. He said, I second it. And they all raised their hand. They said, you're it. I said, I don't know what I am, but show me how. You know, they showed me how. I said, you need to go to Area Seminary. I went to Area Seminary. I hung out with the Area Grapevine person all weekend, and I started meeting people from all over North Carolina. You know, started doing that deal. And, you know, like I said, I was a year and a half sober. I met Buck, and I started traveling with him, going everywhere he went. And that old man, you know, he's getting ready to celebrate 43 years of sobriety. And but that old man, I'm going to tell you, he would go to about 25 or 30 of these a year, and every night of the week we'd go to a meeting. He said, Mike, we leave my house promptly at 6 o'clock. And there'd be four or five guys show up at his driveway, and we'd get in his car, and promptly at 6 o'clock we'd pull out. And if you wasn't there, if you was there at 6:02, you was gone. We were gone, you know. And we went all over the place, and we'd go to these little towns way outside of Charlotte, and one of the guys in the van was speaking. And for the next 6 months, everybody in that van was speaking down there, you know. and just started, you know, and these guys, man, they had a good time in sobriety, you know, and they were, I just sit back and listen to these old guys traveling down the highway, you know, and that's what we do today in, at the Big Town Group. We load that van up. We call it the Big Town Short Bus, and we, we'll have 10, 11 drunks in there, and we'll take off 100 miles down the road, you know, and so we're bringing that to our group up there now, so it's amazing, you know. But I remember, you know, going through the 12 steps with that sponsor, and I remember, you know, doing that four step like it's outlined in our big book, and, you know, I was able to pull all that stuff out of me that was blocking me from the power, you know, and you know, learn what those things are, and, you know, and get in and start making my amends, you know. And I'll tell you, I hear these new guys coming in AA today, and they're 30 days sober, and they're like, yeah, the promises are coming true in my life. You know, and man, I'm going to tell you, them are ninth step promises. And I didn't feel the freedom. I ain't never felt freedom until I started cleaning up the wreckage of my past. Because when I got Alcoholics Anonymous, I was looking over my back, you know, all the time. And as a matter of fact, my name was Scott when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, you know who they are? The ones that's out to get you? You know, I don't know who they are, but they're out there, you know. And I ain't seen them in a while. They ain't tried to get me now. They might be in here, you know. But, you know, but it was awesome, you know. And I started cleaning up the wreckage of my past, you know. And I remember, I remember the effects of the first time I made an amend, you know. And it was just absolutely amazing. It was a woman who her family was friends with my family. And you know, she pretty much kicked me out of her and her family's life. And I was able to go make some amends to this woman. And just the effects that I felt from that was absolutely amazing, you know. And it just made me want to do more of that work, you know. And I cleaned up the wreckage of my past, you know. And I continually try to be, you know, a kind and loving brother and son and, you know, friend and all this stuff. But, you know, that's the rest of my life stuff. But I remember I went back in this church to find family I hadn't seen in 20 years. You know, and I remember I went in this church I grew up in, and I got there early, and by this time I had cleaned up, and I had a suit, and I went in this church, and the preacher was standing there at the door. I got there early, told him why I was there, and he had read our book, and he knew what I was trying to do, and he said, "You got family here." And I remember this woman come up, and she just grabbed me and hugged my neck and said, "Mike, where you been?" And it was a cousin I hadn't seen in 20 years, you know, and I was able to go out to eat with her, and the next week she invited me over to her mama's house, you know, and I went over there, and they had put together a family reunion. And I was able to go in here, you know, all these family members I hadn't seen in 20 years, new family members I've never met, you know, and it was absolutely amazing. They've given me so many gifts. It's absolutely amazing, you know, and I would have missed all that if I hadn't been making my amends. You know, I went back to my mom's, and me and my mom's never been close, and she was living by herself now, and I went up to this house I grew up in. It was around Thanksgiving, and sometime in November. Went up in this house, you know, and it was so cold in there you could see your breath. I opened up the refrigerator, it was empty, and my mama looked like she was starving to death. And I remember, man, we went back through the living room, and all her antiques were gone and all her furniture, and went back in this bedroom. And I remember sitting there, and I said, "What's wrong?" And my mom said, you know, she had lost her job in April, and she was selling her furniture to pay her bills with. And my mama, she's always helped people. You know, she was a nurse for years and years. My grandparents both got sick, and she quit her work and lived on their Social Security and took care of her parents at home until they died. And they both died at home. You know, and she always helped people. And I remember it tore me up to see her living like that, you know. And this was right after, you know, I was 3 years sober. And I had me this apartment, you know, and I started collecting antiques, you know, because I've never owned anything. And I got this, you know, apartment slammed full of antique, beautiful furniture. And I was proud of that stuff, you know. I went home one night, and late at night, and I remember I went to bed, and sometime during the night I rolled over and my arm went underwater. And you can imagine what I thought, and I thought, well, I don't do that no more. I quit drinking. And I jumped out of bed, and it was waist deep. And I was in shock, you know. I don't know what to do. I remember I had a camera on my entertainment center. I started flashing it in there, and it was 280 apartments got flooded out, and it was daybreak on a Sunday morning, and I grew up on this creek bank, and when the water gets high, there's rats and snakes and all kind of, and I had to get some clothes on real quick, and I remember I went outside that apartment, and the water came up to here, And I remember I couldn't get on my knees that morning. I looked up at the sky and I said, God, help me. And he answered my prayer. Help somebody get out. And I started helping my neighbors get out of there. And people started waking up and they were screaming and crying. And, you know, and it was a bad place to be. And I remember I called my first sponsor and AA showed up at 6:30 on a Sunday morning. And AA stayed with me until 1:30 that afternoon. We walked in there and I had lost everything. My van was underwater for 7 hours. And I remember we got in that apartment, you know, we walked back in that bedroom, and that first sponsor, he grabbed me around the neck, and he hugged me, and he said, Mike, cry if you need to, and he cried with me, because I was proud of that stuff. He told me something I thought was pretty crazy. He said, Mike, maybe God wants you to have better stuff. I thought that dude was crazy. But he took me back in his home, you know, and for a month, AA took care of me. They came to his house, they picked me up, took me to work, they brought me home, they fed me, they gave me clothes. I could have filled this room up 5 times with furniture, but I didn't take none up because I didn't have nowhere to put it. But they took care of me, you know, and I was able to get back on my feet. You know, I went to work for this company when I was in treatment, and these people fired me back in the 80s for coming in drunk every day. And if I could have got a DWI on a forklift, I'd have got more than one in that place. When I was in treatment, you know, I went back over there and asked for a job, and first thing they said, do you drink? I said, no, I quit. And I was about 30 days sober, and they hired me. I went to work for these people making $6.35 an hour, and I was happy. I got me a little one-bedroom apartment, bought me that old house to be able to pay my insurance, pay my bills, have me food, went to meetings every day. You know, and I was happy. And every 6 months, they'd give me a raise. I was there for a year. I picked up a welder one day, went over and started messing around. 2 hours later, the boss made come over and said, you weld that? I said, yeah. He said, come on. Started welding for these people. They jacked my pay up, you know, and I worked hard for these people. Man, you won't never believe what I built, man. I built jail bars. At the end of the day, I'd be leaning through them, you know, looking out through the bars. And that 4:30 buzz would go off. I'd go around and go to the house just grateful as I could be, you know. And, and I worked for them people for 13 years. I never had a job over a year and a half. And I worked for these people. And they let me off to go to AA stuff anytime I needed off. You know, they said, if you stay sober, you go. You know, and they, you know, they were real good to me. And they knew what I used to be like, and they saw what happened to me when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and it was amazing. So, you know, by this time, you know, I had all this better stuff. I moved out of that guy's house, got all this better stuff. And, you know, I went home that night after I saw my mama, and I thought, you know, I'd be selfish if I didn't go up there and help my mama. I realized today that it was God's way of putting me and her in each other's life where maybe we can form a relationship that we never had. And I went up there, and I asked my mama if I could come home. Last place I want to go at 28 years old, I want to come home. And my mom said, I wish you would, you know. And I got all that better stuff and took it up there and shared it with my mom. And I remember I'd come to AA meetings and I'd come up to you and I'd say, man, why can't I hug anybody in here and I can't tell my own mom I love her? And they said, Mike, all you got to do is just do it. And it wasn't that easy, you know. She came down the hall one night and I grabbed my mom and I hugged her and I told her I loved her. First time I can ever remember doing that. And she said, I love you too, Mike. And it got easier. And we started forming a relationship. And sooner or later, man, we were like best friends, you know. We'd sit and talk, and she'd tell me about my family. My dad was the number one resentment on my list because he left my mama when she was 7 months pregnant with me with 3 other kids, and he never gave her a dime. And I hated that man. My mama told me about that man. She said, your daddy was a drunk in Charlotte. He was on the streets of Charlotte and doing a lot of illegal stuff on the streets and, went to jail hundreds of times, public drunk. He ended up going to prison on an armed robbery charge. And my mama said I was just like him. And the resentment washed away. Because if I would have had 4 kids when I was out there living the way I was living, I couldn't have took care of them kids. And I know it. You know, and I was able to write my dad a letter. I didn't know where he was at. But I wrote a letter. I sealed it. And I had that thing 3 or 4 months, and a name came to me. I called somebody, and they said, your dad's out in Oregon, out in Grants Pass, Oregon. And I mailed it to my dad, and my dad called me, and I was able to talk to my dad. And it wasn't about what happened in our past. It was about what we're doing right here, right now. You know, and it was amazing. I didn't expect to have no relationship with him. But I just wanted him to know I didn't hate him for leaving. You know, he died right after that. And, you know, thank God I was able to do that, you know. Maybe it was a little piece for, you know, his mind when he left this world. You know, and it's just been amazing stuff like that's happened to me in sobriety. You know, I married my wife in Alcoholics Anonymous, and, you know, I've got an amazing wife. Some of y'all have met her. She's taught over at the Texas State, and she's just an amazing woman. She sponsors a lot of women. I sponsor a lot of guys, and we stay in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Both of us go into jail meetings. I go into two different jails every week, and, you know, that's the bright spot of my life, is going in them jails, man. You know, I go in these jails, and it's the first time these guys hear of AA. It's like a 12-step call every Monday, Wednesday night in these jails. You know, and we're the first examples they see before they go to these prisons. And y'all know about prisons in North Carolina. We got some strong AA down there and then prison system down there, you know, with old Tom out down there. And, you know, so we're preparing them in there, letting them know what we are and what we ain't while in that jail, and let them get down in them prison meetings. You know, so it's amazing work that we get to do down there. It's fun. You know, it's fun. It's become a way of life for us. You know, and back in 86, my mom, well, that's when I moved in with my mom. In 98, I was supposed to go up to Blackstone, Virginia, and on a Thursday morning, and I told Buck, I said, I can't go. My mom's sick. And he said, all right. And so I remember my mom, she was a nurse most of her life, and them were the hardest kind to get to go to the doctor. And she done diagnosed herself, you know, and she was sick, you know. And I told her, I said, I'm taking you to the hospital. I said, in the morning, if you're not ready to go, I'm going to pick you up and I'm going to carry you to the, put you in my car, and we're going to the hospital. And so I woke up early that next morning on Thursday morning, and she was getting dressed. And I took her to the hospital. They did x-rays, and they put her upstairs in a room. And I stayed with my mom till 7 o'clock that evening. And my mama said, Mike, there's nothing you can do here. You need to be with them AA people up in Virginia. And so I left, and I went up to Blackstone, when I got back, I called her doctor, and her doctor said, you know, I asked her, I said, you know, so what's up with my mom? And he told me, he said, your mom has terminal lung cancer, and she's not going to live long. And I said, well, how long is that? He said, maybe 3 months. And, boy, that just tore my heart out, you know. Here I am, you know, in my 30s, and I'm finally getting a relationship with my mom, and now she's getting ready to leave, you know. I brought my mom home, you know, and I took care of my mama. And one of the hardest things I ever did, you know, and I knew I wanted my mama to die at home because she took care of her parents at home, and they both died there. And I'll tell you, she didn't want anybody in the house but hospice. And I talked her into letting me have some of these old-time AA women come in, you know, to hang out with me, and, you know, and AA would bring me groceries and stuff, you know, and it was hard. And I remember late at night, my mama climbing in my bed, and she'd put her hand on my shoulder, and she'd be crying like a baby. And all I needed to do was just to hold her. And I'd hold my mama. And I would reflect back on my past at the things that I put that woman through. I come off some railroad tracks one night drinking Everclear, chasing it with long neck Budweisers. I don't remember coming off them railroad tracks. I came to on the living room floor of that house, and my mama knew about alcoholism. And my mama was holding her baby boy in her arms on that floor, taking care of her baby through his sickness. And I remember I got up off that floor, and I had tore that whole house up in a blackout. I broke everything you can break in that house. And I can't imagine the fear I put in my grandparents and my mama that night. So thank God I was taught about being responsible and do the next right thing. And that was what I was supposed to be doing. And I was supposed to be sitting there, and I was supposed to be laying there and holding my mama in my arms and letting her know I loved her through her sickness. Because she ain't got 12 steps. You know, what an awesome experience that was. I was able to be there with my mama when my mama died. What an honor that is. You know, I remember when the hospice people came in, man, my mama tried to hook me up with his hospice nurse. You know, I was single at the time, and my mom didn't realize this woman was gay, and it wasn't going to happen, you know. I'll tell you what, man, my wife today is a hospice nurse. It ain't the same one, but I got me one. And my wife's absolutely amazing. We built our dream home up on top of a mountain a few years ago, a log cabin up 2,800 foot up on top of this mountain, 180-degree view of the Blue Ridge Mountains just rolling hills as far as you can see. You know, and it was an awesome dream, and it came true. And we shared it with hundreds of AA people. Hundreds of AA people. And matter of fact, Tom and Steve met, you know, Steve and all them guys, they've come up and stayed up there at the house. And, you know, it's just been an absolutely amazing experience, you know. And the house went into foreclosure, and we lost it a couple years ago, or, well, it's been a little over a year ago. And it was okay with us. It was okay with us. You know, we had to make another eight-step list. We had to go back and make some amends, credit, you know, a lot of credit stuff, and we've done that. And we're taking care of all that, you know. We didn't want to file bankruptcy, you know. We just thought, you know, that's an easy way out. We owe these people money, you know, and we made a list. And we've contacted everybody we owe money, and we're paying that money back. But I remember I had some physical stuff going on. I had some gallstones, and in the blood work, they found out I was diabetic, and they found out I had hep C, and I did a year of that interferon treatment, and it didn't work, and one of the things, when I went on that stuff, man, I got two brand new guys put in my path, and I stayed in the big book with these guys, and I took them through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I took them to meetings all over the place, and I did what I was supposed to do, you know, and I've heard, man, I've heard some awesome stuff around here this weekend, you know. And I heard Dave talk about, stay close to him and perform his work well, and he provides for us, man. And that's exactly what's happened for us, you know. It wasn't a big deal losing that house. We didn't, you know, that was a dream that came true. It's gone. We're working for another dream over here. You know, we were provided for. We're even in a better house on 4 acres of land on the bottom of the mountain where we ain't got to hike up the mountain in the snow anymore. You know what I mean? We ain't got to hike up the mountain in the snow anymore, you know. We can drive right up to our door down there. You know, we're out in the woods. We're out in the woods on 4 acres, you know. And on Saturday night when we're not traveling, we have a campfire meeting at the house. We bring in people and they eat with us, you know. We hang out there and have a good time in sobriety. You know, that's all, you know. We try to teach these people we sponsor, you know, that you can have a good time. You know, and it's absolutely amazing, you know, getting these new guys. And I'll tell you what I found out about that is, man, there is no bigger honor than a guy walking into your home group and he can't look you in the face. And you know what that man's going through. You know how bad he's hurting. You know, and you go over and reach your hand out and shake that man's hand and welcome him to Alcoholics Anonymous. I go into meetings today, it looks like Night of the Living Dead in that place. And they're sitting around, you know, spread out, and they don't acknowledge anybody coming in the door. You know, and everybody in my group gets over there and they welcome this guy. You know, and when that guy comes up to you and say, man, will you show me how to live my life? I don't know how to live without drinking. You know, what an honor that is. What an honor. And to be able to take that guy through the 12 steps and watch his life change and see that light come on in his eye, man, that is absolutely amazing. That's the power of God right there in his face, you know. That's just, man, that, and how can you not believe? How can you not believe? You know, and, it's been absolutely amazing. I'm getting ready to close. I heard a story about a man who lived down on the beach, and I think a woman named Peggy used to tell this story. And every morning this guy, he'd walk down the beach, and he saw way off in the distance somebody was picking something up and throwing it in the ocean. Well, when he got down there, he saw where thousands of starfish washed up. And he got down to the man, he said, what are you doing? He said, well, I'm throwing these starfish back in the ocean. The guy looked around, and he said, what difference can you make? There's thousands of them. There's thousands. And he reached down and he picked one up and he said, it makes all the difference in the world to this one. And he threw him back in the ocean. Now, I can relate to that story. You know, our book talks about the way we roar through people's lives like a tornado. I know today everybody I come in contact with out there drinking, man, I affected some kind of way. And I honestly believe that the wind stopped blowing that morning and I ended up in that courtroom. I know today that judge knew more about me than I knew about myself. That judge was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the thousands of drunks that go through that courtroom, he picked me up, and he threw me in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as a result of becoming willing to ask another man to help me, to work those 12 steps in my life and try to practice the principles behind those steps the day and time of my life, there's no doubt in my mind this program saved my life. There is no doubt in my mind. And I'll tell you, man, I'd like to thank y'all again for inviting me out here to Texas, man. I love Texas AA. And thank y'all. Thank you.